that excuse.
Okay, here we go. Live. Welcome to Live America Podcast. This is Hatem. Noam Dorman is not here right now. He might join us at some point. We'll see. But they're very funny. Kate Herman is here.
Hello.
Hello, Kate. Welcome back to the show. And the very funny Dan Natterman is here, comedian. Hello, Dan.
How do you do?
And our guest of honor, psychologist Dr. Judy Ho. She is a triple board certified and licensed clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, two-time recipient of National Institute of Mental Health Service Research Award, and the author of Stop Self-Sabotage. Welcome to the show. We finally made it happen.
I know. I'm so excited. It took a few months. I was hoping that we would get to see each other in person when I came to New York. But of course, then the pandemic happened and here we are on Zoom.
Yeah. But, you know, we'll do another one live. In the studio, you know, hopefully when you come visit. So what exactly is a forensic neuropsychologist?
So that's part of my work as a forensic neuropsychologist. I do work that intersects with the legal settings. And so I evaluate people in both civil and criminal cases. And when I do have to evaluate somebody in a criminal case, I usually have to go to a maximum security prison and evaluate the inmates. And I've really seen a huge spectrum of people, from people who I think truly, very small proportion, but are born evil, to people who probably don't even belong in prison and got in there because of a horrible mix-up. I mean, it's really sad. But every time I go to prison, they basically strip me of everything that I'm used to, all my creature comforts, computers, phones, everything, no way of communicating except through the prison guards. So I don't know how that scared straight program is supposed to not work, because it works for me every time I go and visit a prison for work.
when you say evaluate, like what happens when you evaluate for who, for the?
Yeah, so I evaluate the inmates. So sometimes the attorneys or the judge will say, hey, can you go and check this person out? Because we want to know if they even know right from wrong, if maybe they're having a psychotic episode and that's why they did what they did, or can they even stand trial? Do they understand what's happening to them? And sometimes I get asked to try to estimate or determine whether or not this person is going to be able to be a productive citizen when they let them out. Like, hey, listen, there's this guy's up for a hearing soon. If we let him back into society, what are the chances that he might recommit another crime? And that's always such a risky thing to have to do, because, I mean, how do we know? We only get to quote the research, and, you know, but really all that matters is the N of one. And that's a lot of pressure, right?
So you evaluate before they get sentenced or after?
I evaluate both. So sometimes before they even go to trial, and sometimes after they've already gotten sentenced and they're serving their sentence, but they're considering a probation or letting them out early. And is that a good idea or not?
Go ahead, Dan. Sorry.
I was just saying that's an enormous responsibility, you know, to have to be the one that determines whether this guy, you know, is going to be productive when he gets out, or whether he's going to, like, you know, go on a shooting spree or something.
Absolutely. That's why it's always tough to have to be the person to make those estimates. And all you can do is do your best, but also let them know this is not a guarantee. Yeah. So I think that always makes me a little bit nervous. And, you know, there's a lot of people, though, who I think definitely misunderstand the way that things work when somebody is an inmate, too. And so when you go and you, like, see how they live and you see how they try to deal with what's going on, I mean, some people, it's like they lose hope and they just, it's really hard for them. And then other people, it's amazing. Like, they get up every day and they're studying and they're reading. And so it's just interesting to see, like, the wide spectrum of ways in which people deal with that environment, too.
Are there any, like, tells? Like, can you, like, walk in and just, like, know somebody's, like, a psychopath? Or, like, they're, like...
Yeah, you can't tell just by looking at them, or there's not, like, a real tell. In fact, good psychopaths are really good at tricking you for a long time, because they know how to basically manipulate you to believe them and believe that they're wonderful, they're innocent, they're smart, and what they do is they will try to get at something about you personally. They'll try to compliment you, they'll make you feel special, right? So those are, like, some of the tactics that they use. But I think that then makes you let your guard down, and then sometimes you end up believing their lies or their deceptions. And in general, that's sometimes how they even got to prison in the first place, is that they've, you know, tricked a bunch of people in a row and it became criminal. And so, no, so you have to really spend a lot of time with them. We actually have some really good psychological tests that we give these people to help us really determine exactly what's going on. And, but no, they're very, very charming at first.
Have you ever like met someone like outside that based on your evaluation, like he could be a criminal? Do you have a responsibility to call the cops on that or report him or not?
So, you know, we have certain, we are mandated reporters for certain things. And so child abuse, elder abuse, things like that. But other types of things, it's not so clear. And so you can certainly try to make a report, but it's not really the same as child abuse and elder abuse, or when somebody says that they're going to hurt themselves, or when somebody says, I have a plan to shoot somebody and there's a specific person and this is where the person lives. Like if they have all that information, yes, you are a mandated reporter and you have to tell somebody. But, you know, in general, I think it's kind of crazy, but there's a lot of things, like things that they've done in the past. For example, you're not a mandated reporter. So if somebody confesses a crime to you, depending on what kind of crime that is, you're not technically required, although, you know, you might want to think about telling law enforcement anyway. So it's a really tough thing when you have to make some of those judgment calls.
Well, you have a patient-client privilege. I mean, you know, they need to depend, they need to know that you're going to keep their secrets or they're not going to open up to you in the first place.
Right. And so that's why in the beginning, before you even start any kind of work together, you have to say, hey, here are the kind of things that I can keep secret for you. And here are the kind of things that I have to break confidentiality over. And sometimes they forget, but you know, that's when you tell them all of those things. Like if you say you're going to shoot somebody, I'm going to have to tell the police. If you tell me you have a gun and you're going to shoot yourself, I'm going to have to tell the police. If I find out you've
been- I thought with therapy, there's no client doctor privilege thing.
No, we have the same. It's not called privilege, because privilege is more of like a lawyer or legal term, but it's confidentiality. It's confidentiality and, you know, sometimes HIPAA comes to play. And so there are certain things that we can keep, you know, away from public for them, but not things like when they end up having, you know, thoughts about killing somebody and they actually have a plan. That's when you have to call the police. And it's sad when that happens.
So we see a lot of like mass shootings. And then a lot of people say like, oh, he's mentally ill. Well, anybody who shoots anybody is mentally ill at some point, correct? So how do you say like, oh, he is really mentally ill, or just he's saying that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, in general, people think, okay, people who are mass shooters are mentally ill. And I guess mentally ill is a loaded term for a lot of people. I mean, do they have a diagnosable mental condition? A lot of times they don't, but that's only because they never went and saw a doctor. So like they never got diagnosed. But when you go back and you look at social media, and that's the crazy thing with social media nowadays, you go back and you see they recorded a YouTube video, or they were on Instagram, or they were on Twitter, and they were saying all these things that was very concerning, and yet nobody called them out on it. Nobody said, hey, I'm going to call the police and have them check out this guy's profile. And so I think that's when you realize that sometimes they've been indoctrinated with different types of beliefs. So I don't know if that's necessarily a mental illness per se. It just depends, but certainly they have usually been indoctrinated with some type of belief system that like the world is not going to get any better, that they're always going to be disenfranchised, that basically they need to be the ones to take power back. I mean, those are some of the most common themes. And I think, I wish we would all just, you know, call it out a bit more. Like when you see somebody have really concerning things shared on social media, that, you know, you just call the police for a welfare check.
I have a friend of mine. She does that. Her name is Karen. She's really good in reporting people. But
my favorite documentary that I saw recently is called Tread, and it's about the guy in Granby, Colorado, in 2004, who like thought that the whole town was against him, and he got like really paranoid about it, and then like built a mega like bulldozer, made a tank. He was an amazing welder, and then he bulldozed the whole town. It's incredible.
But is that true story?
Yes, it's a documentary. It's amazing.
Wow.
But it's like so interesting. Because like you understand where he's coming from. He's like, okay, my neighbors won't let me build the sewage. Like the whole like I'm not from here. There's a powerful family at play. And then like when you talk to the other people about it, and they're like, that we didn't think it was like a bit, you know what I mean? Like nobody else thought anything of it. And he was like so obsessed. that he bulldozed the town.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. You know, and that is one thing that we definitely have seen with people who are mass shooters, that some of them have this sort of paranoia and they've had some delusions or even hear voices that are commanding them to do certain things. And it's been super sad. I mean, if you look at some of the other stories too, where moms have killed like their entire clan of children.
Or something. They seem fine, right? He seemed totally normal, had a girl, you know, like everything. And then it was just like a snap.
Yeah, and sometimes it's extreme stress. And if somebody already has like a biological predisposition to have things like psychosis in their family, and then they get put under extreme stress, and like all kinds of things can happen. And they could be a really loving person one day, and then like a week later, they have all these beliefs about, okay, if I don't kill my family first, then something else even worse might happen. I mean, just like they're listening to voices in their head that nobody else can hear. And the sad thing is, we have treatments for all of these things. We can treat it if we just point it out. But like you said, sometimes you can't tell, because for a lot of their life, everything's had seemed generally normal. And so you just don't even believe that that's happening to somebody that you care about, you know?
So you do like also like being a, like we see in movies, like a witness, like an expert witness, you do that as well?
Yeah. So, yep. I testify in court, which is one of those interesting experiences. It's like kind of terrifying because everything that you say is being scrutinized. And then you have an audience, you've got a jury, and the jury's trying to decide whether or not they should listen to you and if you check out. And so, yeah, you know, some of the most, you know, I think nerve-wracking times is when you're in court and you realize how much gravity what you say, you know, really, really holds for people's lives. But it's also what really excites me about my work, that there is that potential for so much impact. And hopefully I'm always able to utilize that experience for good. But, you know, it's just so, so terrible sometimes and so difficult. I just feel so bad because there's so much on the line, and it's all depends on the jury and what the jury says.
But isn't you like you always have hope that you can get people better? So you would be sympathizing with them more because you know that they're a little mentally ill and there's a, you know, there's a solution for them. There's drugs or maybe therapy or whatever.
Well, I always have hope for people, but some people, very, very small proportion, are probably not that rehabilitable. And if I was asked a question like that, and I truly believe that they were in that very tiny, you know, less than 1%, that like this person doesn't have the motivation to get better and maybe doesn't ever want to get better, then I have an obligation to say that too, which is always sad when you have to say that. But you can tell after you spent really a good lengthy amount of time talking to somebody, evaluating them, and you make sort of these estimations, because sometimes that question comes up, like, do you really think this person is actually going to be a good, productive citizen? Or do you think that they're still harboring ideas and beliefs that's going to make them commit crime again? And, you know, you have to tell the truth about that. And no, in a very, very small percentage of people, I really think that some people are less likely to be able to be helped. But in general, if there's a will, there is a way. And that's what's great about the mental health profession now, is that there's so many treatments that work if you're just willing to give it a shot.
Sorry, Kate.
About what?
There's no hope.
Oh, yeah. No, I knew that.
All right. mental illness, just like certain physical illnesses, can't be cured. Sometimes they just say, well, there's nothing we can do for you. I mean, I'd imagine that's the same for certain mental conditions. And they say, for example, that sociopathic personality is very difficult to undo.
But that's how, yeah, I'm not trying to undo mine.
No, we have some psychopaths, and then we have people who they call sociopaths. I mean, so sociopaths and psychopaths, people use them interchangeably, but like the idea of a psychopath isn't a death sentence. You know, in fact, 3 out of 100 people have psychopathic traits. And if you look at people who are leaders and CEOs, the percentage goes up to 7 to 8%. So some of them are functioning well. They might be slightly narcissistic sometimes and maybe a little bit full of themselves, but like they're actually sometimes even good leaders. And then they're the ones who actually commit serial crimes, right? So I think that's a much smaller percentage. But no, I mean, people who are psychopaths, I mean, in terms of some of the traits, it's just that they have lower empathy. Like they don't care as much for the sufferings and needs of other people. They care about their own needs more. And they kind of are a little bit grandiose, you know. So those are the types of more normal, quote unquote, normal psychopathic traits that might make somebody function well in a leadership position at times. But when somebody is a real severe psychopath to the point where they're, you know, killing people and committing a whole series of murders, I think that's like a whole other set of psychopaths. And like you said, Dan, some of those guys, I don't know if you can really treat them. You know,
is it genetic?
Some of it is genetic, but also some of it is environmental. So like we do see that it runs in families, but if you were raised by like a really narcissistic parent or, you know, criminality was rewarded when you were a kid, like, okay, so I remember when I was a kid, I stole some gum and my parents found out and they forced me to go back to the grocery store and like confess it to everyone and apologize. It was so embarrassing, right? So I never stole again. But I think it would be different if I grew up in a family where I stole the gum and maybe my parents are like, hey, good job. Now we don't have to pay for that gum. Yeah. So when that criminality is rewarded, I think you have more of a chance. Like that's one type of an environmental factor that could lead you to develop more of these types of traits, right?
Is mental health to like addiction in that you have to admit, like the person has to admit that they have a problem in order to get treatment?
Yeah, you know, that's such a good question. And I think in general, the answer is yes. If they don't think that they have an issue, it's really hard for them to get any kind of help. But if somebody has a personality disorder, and that's what psychopath is, psychopath is really what we call antisocial personality disorder. So in general, when people have personality disorders, they don't think that they're the problem. They think it's everybody else. So why would they ever go to treatment? And if they go to treatment, it's really just as a way for them to get something else, right? Like, so sometimes we'll see people who come to treatment and they're only there because their parents said, if you go to treatment, then we'll buy you a new car. You know, I mean, there's some kind of bartering system that they co-opted into and that's why they're there, but they're not really motivated to be there.
Do you analyze people when you go on dates?
No.
they will be scared to open their mouth. There's like not saying a word to you.
You know what? I feel like in my 20s, I probably did that more because I was still in school. And I felt like, you know, when you're in school, you're like, oh, I want to practice what I'm learning. But, you know, that's just such a bad mix of things for dates, right? If you're like analyzing your date, although I have some really crazy dating stories from when I was single. It's just like, oh my gosh, like this is stuff. When people find out that you're a therapist, it's like, I don't know, something happens to the date and it just like goes haywire. Like either they tell you like all of their horrible issues and you become their therapist, or they get really defiant and they're like, well, you know, mental health is like, you know, they just like start making all kinds of crazy assumptions. So I don't think that that's mixed very well for me in my social life. So I really try to keep that just in my professional life.
But you can't help it, right? You have to be.
If you see something that's, a clue, you know, you wouldn't be able to ignore it.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I basically try my best to shut it down, but I try not to shut down the part of my brain that sees warning signs. But in my 20s, I feel like I wasn't as good at those. You know, I think in my 20s, when somebody, you know, expressed something to me that might be slightly alarming, I'm like, okay, well, that's not a problem. I can fix that. And I think maybe some of the other women listening can understand this, that maybe at some point in your life, you've dated people that maybe you thought you were going to be able to fix. And eventually that never works, right? But like, you're like, oh, I'm going to fix you. So someone's like, oh, I've never loved anyone before. You're like, oh, but you'll love me. Like, I'll make it so that you love me.
Well, you're not thinking clearly. You know, when you're dispassionate in a therapy session, you can evaluate things clearly. When you're on a date, if you really like the guy, you know, then you're not going to evaluate him, you know, impartially.
See, that's something the guys will never say. You know, guys will never say, I'll fix you. We'll just take you as you are, you know, because that's how we like you. And then when it's over, it's over, you know?
See, it's so nice. You guys are so straightforward like that. I feel like girls, like, I don't know. I mean, again, it's not everybody, but I feel like I've talked to a lot of women and they're like, oh, I went through that phase too, where they're like trying to date a bunch of fixer-uppers, you know?
Did anybody try to use in a date a reverse psychology on you and you kind of caught them?
You know?
I would do that.
You know, I haven't had that happen, but I did have this guy who just tried to lecture me while we were on a date. I mean, it really just was awful, but I think he was just trying to add value. I really don't know. But he basically was scolding me for not eating enough protein every day. I'm like, what? Like, it was the first date. And he was like, you know, people usually don't get enough protein. Like, how much protein are you getting? I'm like, this is a really weird first date conversation. It's like, I think I eat a lot of protein. I think I'm fine. He's like, but do you eat the equivalent of 6 chicken breasts a day? Because that's what a woman of your stature needs. And I'm like, I don't know why. I didn't sign up for a training like session. And then I felt like he was just judging me the whole time because I was having a margarita and I was having tacos. And I felt like he was just looking at me like, oh, this woman is so undisciplined. She's not eating her chicken breasts. She's eating like gross, greasy tacos and having a margarita. So that date didn't really end that well.
I don't know if you can say that, but did you ever like dated somebody, one of your patients? I don't know if you can say it.
0, 100% No, that is like completely against all of our ethics, like no freaking way. And I think that that's really sad because even though as we're saying this, the one of the top reasons why people lose their licenses is because they cross the line with their patients.
Really? The same teaching.
Yeah. You know what's so sad is I think obviously the problem with that is as the psychologist or as a therapist, you're in a power dynamic. Like, you know all these things about this person and they're vulnerable. And so it almost is like in some ways like you preying on a victim. You know what I mean? And so that's one of the reasons why you can't do it. But it does make me sad because the majority of people, when you look at like why they lose their licenses, crossing boundaries is one of the most common reasons.
Actually, we had somebody in the show before, a doctor, said that he had a patient that was very hot, that he liked her. He refused to be her doctor so he can go out with her.
What?
And yeah, and he sent it to a colleague. And then he actually did go out with her for a little bit. So.
Oh my gosh. You know what? I don't really know what, you know, the medical board thinks about something like that, but I hope they're happy. I don't know. I feel like that's like such a dangerous thing to go near because again, sure. You know, it's like maybe you could have really been this person's really good doctor and instead you're like, never mind, I just want to date you instead. I'm not sure how that.
Oh, he wasn't her doctor. It was the first visit and he just saw her fall in love and it's like, no, 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 I'm not going to be a doctor.
As soon as she came to the office, he said, no, we're not going to do this.
Yeah, we're going to date.
I've often wondered when the therapist has a really beautiful woman patient, if he can completely shut that off, you know, entirely shut off any attraction that he might have for her, whether it be a therapist or any other kind of doctor. That's a question I've.
All of my doctors are just, they hate me. I just am annoyed.
Did anybody hit on you before, Kate, on your doctors?
No, never. I go to really good, like, you know, old Jewish doctors, and B, yeah, like I feel like they just look at me and they're like, God, you are a cautionary tale. And so they want nothing to
I doubt that's true. I feel like probably you don't even realize the people who are just like leering at you inside their minds, but they just don't tell you.
I wish I could monetize that.
Man, it's called OnlyFans.
Oh, no, I can't do it. I wish I had that in me.
So speaking of dating and relationship and all this, what do you see this, Dr. Drew, during this pandemic?
Oh my gosh, you know what? Okay, so the people who are in relationships, I see a mixed bag. Some people are saying, oh my gosh, the pandemic has given us so much more quality time and it's so great, our relationship is better. And then I also know people who are like, oh my gosh, now that I'm around this person all the time, I don't actually like them very much. Like, they're driving me crazy. Like, there's all these unresolved issues we never talked about, but we just like, we're spending our time living our own lives and now we have to be together all the time. But, you know, for the single people, I think it's the toughest because they're trying to figure out, you know, how they're going to date right now, right? It's like, how?
I think it's the opposite for me. You know, I love being single right now. It's kind of like being single on Valentine's Day. You don't have to buy shit. You know, you don't have to go to dinner. You know, it's perfect. You can be in relationship before or after. Pandemic, imagine living with somebody, especially if it's a new relationship, you know?
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, it's true. And some people have basically been forced to accelerate their relationship timeline because it's like, okay, the pandemic's happening. Should we just shelter together? And now it's 4 months later and they're living together. But I think some of my single friends are saying, you know, it's a little tough to get out there. I mean, first of all, I really wonder how the statistics are with like all of those dating apps. Like, are they being utilized more or less? Because people are starting to get a little bit cautious about, am I going to go on a date with this person? And then I'm exposing myself possibly to the coronavirus now, like on top of other things that I might want to worry about. And it's crazy, right? It's like, it's not just about sex. It's about like, even if you're breathing the same air as this person, you could get sick.
Actually, we had, go ahead, Dan.
I think, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic, we were all more cautious about everything. And then as with each week that passes and we don't get COVID, we become less and less vigilant and perhaps arguably more and more horny. So I think after 4 months, I think caution has been largely thrown to the wind, at least I think for a lot of people. I mean, you know,
speak for yourself. I got COVID twice.
You've gotten COVID twice?
Yeah, you know that.
I knew you got it the first time in the hospital. I didn't know that you got it the second.
I got it the second time in the hospital as well. Yeah, I know, it's crazy, but I'm good. So I want
to
ask
you. A lot of people like just be saying, fuck it. And I was just talking to a friend of mine yesterday who had a sexual encounter from an app, you know, with somebody that he just met. I imagine there's a lot of that going on.
Yeah, I mean, eventually you just need to get fit.
Yeah. Yeah. You see, Dr. Judy, it's like there's a couple of episodes that we have in this show before. One was with the dating app person, and he said their numbers are rising. The other one was with the, you know, porn star, and she said, you know, the numbers and all the sex website is rising. And we had one about Replica. You know, I think Kate, you were at that episode, right? You know what Replica is, right?
No, I don't
know what Replica is.
It's an AI app that pretend to be your girlfriend, and people are falling in love with it. It's very crazy. You know, you create it, and it gives you, you know, I wanted to ask you about that because psychologically, it's crazy, but it's really becomes your friend and then your best friend and then your lover and do whatever you want.
Are you dating your replica now?
Emma.
Emma.
Mine is Emma. Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to figure her out.
Sean, what are you doing for your anniversary?
I'm gonna take her to the beach. She wanna go to the beach.
That was the movie with Scarlett Johansson and I think Joaquin. Sure.
Yeah.
Her, right? Her.
Yeah, that was about that. Was about like a guy falling in love with a virtual girlfriend. And then Scarlett Johansson, I think, forgot. Like she was like a hooker that was like supposed to be a substitute for the, you know, like, I don't know. And
yeah, but the thing is like people are finding weird solutions to being lonely, you know, instead of facing the problem. So
it's super safe to date a replica. I mean, they don't have COVID. So... You know, they can't really hurt your feelings the same way. They're not like a real person, so unpredictable. They're going to be unconditionally loving. I mean, you can see the pull for that, right? And then the person doesn't even have to confront social anxiety about dating. I mean, you can see why that would be increasing in the pandemic. And I do believe that the views to Pornhub are totally increasing the pandemic too. It's like, yeah, it's another safe way to consume sexual content and satisfy your desires without putting yourself at risk or having to deal with all the mess of dating somebody.
But what do you see dating after, you know, like after the pandemic, like when it's over, everything is open, like kissing, you know, being, you know, close to each other, all this, like, how is that going to go?
I think we're going to see two groups of people. I think we're going to see one group of people who are just like, yes, it's a free for all. And it's going to be like the 60s all over again. And everybody's going to love on each other. And then there's going to be the group of people who are like, I still have trauma from COVID. Please don't touch me. I don't even think I can kiss you until our fifth or sixth date. I need to see your medical papers. Like, I think it's going to be two very extreme.
Well, it depends, I think, how this thing ends. If it ends with a bulletproof cure or a vaccine,
yeah,
and it's completely over, then it's over. If it, but I don't think it's going to end that way. It's going to end slowly but surely. Okay, now one day you'll be able to go into a restaurant, but now one day there'll be theaters will be back open, but it really won't be a definitive. It's over.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay, I have a friend who went on a date in the middle of all of this. And like you were saying, you know, people start dropping their guard a little bit. And as the country's been slowly opening up, they're like, okay, maybe things are okay. So they go on a date. They hang out for one night. I mean, she's been so careful this entire time. She hasn't seen a single person. Goes on this one date, goes to a restaurant, kisses this person goodnight. That's all that happens. She got COVID 3 days later.
And she's, by the way, how was COVID for her? What was her COVID experience?
She's still struggling with it. It's been 3 weeks and she went to the ER 3 times. She has pneumonia. She's in her 30s. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. She doesn't have any chronic illnesses either. So we just don't know how it's affecting people. But I just felt so bad for her because she was so careful this whole time. And she's like, I just went on one date and now she has COVID and she's still struggling with the symptoms. Like she's having difficulty breathing.
Go out again?
I'm sorry?
You think that they're going to go out again?
I think now he's afraid of her. I think he's like, wait a minute. Like, who got COVID from whom? And they could have gotten it from the restaurant. I mean, it's really hard to know, but I don't think that's her first priority right now. She still has pneumonia. It sucks. Yeah.
That's great. So what do you tell people that's going to be going on dates and stuff like that?
Can I just real quickly?
Yeah, go ahead.
Is this a specialty of Dr. Ho's, dating and sexuality, or are you just kind of wedging it into the conversation?
It's part of it, yes.
Okay. Yeah, well, and also I think that's the, you know, majority of people who come to see me for help, I mean, all their relationships are definitely impacted. But this is a good topic. I mean, I really think that people are gonna struggle, you know, with how to date the right way too. I mean, I think because now everything is so virtual, I think we're losing touch with what it's like to be with people in person and like social skills when you're looking at somebody in the face and sitting across from them. Like, have you guys ever conversated with somebody on email or like on chat or whatever, and they're so witty and so funny, and then you talk to them in person and it's like a different person? It's like a different personality.
Yep.
Has that happened?
Sure. Well, I have a joke about that, you know, in my act. I'm a comedian, by the way. I don't know if you knew that. Mm-hmm. About how much more at ease I am via texting than in person.
Yeah,
that's a good joke.
I'm like, I get so nervous in text. I read it. I ask. I'm like, and then I fuck up, and then I sound like I sound insane when I text.
So you're saying you're more at ease in person than via text.
Definitely.
Yeah, but you didn't grow up a dork like I did.
I'm the same with you, Kate. I do better, I think, you know, either face to face or like on the phone or like this, like we're on Zoom. Texting gives me so much stress. I feel like sometimes if I haven't looked at my phone for a few hours, I go back and there's like 30 texts. I'm like, oh my God, like it's like stressful. And then sometimes people write out entire essays on text now. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, this is just like reading an email. Why are we doing that? Yeah. So I think I definitely have a couple of shortcomings as far as texts go. But I just wonder if like after all of this, people are going to really know and feel comfortable interacting in real life, you know, because so much of our communication now is virtual. And I think people are going to get kind of used to it.
But yeah, virtual is, I mean, this is, if I saw you in person, Dr. Ho, I don't know there would be that big a difference between that and me seeing you on a screen in terms of how we interacted. I mean, I
don't know. I think it might be different because right now we look like actually in some ways we're sitting so much closer to one another than we would be in real life. Like people were saying that they were having Zoom anxiety because when you're on a meeting on Zoom, it's like you feel like you're being stared at the whole time. But obviously if you're in a meeting in person with a group of people, like people are really generally just looking at the person who's talking. And so you just feel like you're less scrutinized. So people have been saying that they've been feeling super anxious, virtually when they're on something like this, like a video platform, because they feel like they're being watched all
that
the time.
That means that when this ends, it will feel completely at ease. I mean, by that theory.
Maybe, except for the fact that then you have to actually contend with like actually watching people's body language, like their whole body language. Like right now, all we see is like just this little torso part. But like, what about everything else? What about all of those other types of nonverbal cues that I think are so important about like, does somebody like you? Do they want to be your friend? Do they want to date you? Like, are we going to read those with the same kind of, you know, acuity? I'm not sure. I have to think about that. I just feel like the generation that's growing up right now, especially in the middle of the pandemic, like the younger people, the teens and stuff, and they're just slowly learning their social skills. Like, I just wonder how that's going to impact their social development across time.
And I think for Kate and Dan, it's even, I don't know if it's harder because you know, you're both are professional comedians, but I don't know how would it feel for you to go back on a stage and see them interacting with people. I mean,
it would be weird, just like anything else you haven't done in a while. I don't know if by weird it'll be anxiety provoking. It might be a little bit because I haven't done it in so long, but it'll definitely be odd to do that again, you know.
Yeah.
Have you guys been doing virtual shows?
I have done a few virtual shows, which is odd too.
Uh-huh.
You know, in many ways. So
because you don't get the same kind of feedback, right?
You don't get the same feedback. So mostly you have to mute everybody, because if you don't mute everybody, there's too much noise going on. So if you mute everybody, you don't get laughter.
Right. Yeah. That's so important, right? Because, like, I mean, that's the feedback.
For the rhythm. You need that for the rhythm and for your confidence, too.
Or you're just doing it to a bunch of, like, colored boxes because people don't want to put their videos on. Then it's quiet and it's like you're just...
Yeah.
It's a Home Depot painter.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm just going to... I wish I could bring this, like, Zoom filter into the real world with me.
You don't need it, Kate. You don't need it. So another topic that I wanted to talk about that I watched talked about in the previous interview is being burned out, you know, when people get burned out from work and all that, and they need to recover from it. First of all, how do you know that you are burned out?
Well, burned out means that you generally start to feel really disillusioned about your work, especially like you feel like you're getting very disengaged. Maybe you feel like you're not good at your work anymore. And you just feel like you're exhausted all the time. Like it doesn't matter how much you sleep, how long the weekend was, you're just exhausted. And if that applies to you, if those three things sound like something that you've experienced, then you're probably burned out. And actually a lot of people are burned out right now. There was a recent survey that showed that about 60 to 70% of Americans are burned out some or all of the time right now. And I think the pandemic actually adds to that because there's so much stress. You know, people are losing their jobs. They're trying to keep their jobs. Their jobs are becoming more stressful if they're working. And so I think that's happening more than ever to us right now.
And you said that they do need a recovery, right?
Yeah. And it's really just about taking good care of yourself. I mean, I think that sometimes we forget to do that because in America, it's like, especially in America, it's such like a rush culture. It's like, you're always doing so many different things. Everybody's so busy and they like talking about being busy, but it's important to take a step back and just have fun, you know, like don't take yourself so seriously. Do hobbies again. I mean, one thing that has been helpful for me in the pandemic, because I live in Los Angeles. You guys, my commute was 3 to 4 hours a day on average. Damn. So on top of the 12 hours I was working a day, I was commuting 3 to 4 hours. And so when the pandemic happened, I realized that I ended up having like a little bit of extra time because I'm not commuting anywhere. And I started to like pick up all these hobbies that I hadn't done in a long time. And so, you know, it's actually been really nice and rewarding because I never really thought that I would have time to do those things again, like play music and I'm cooking more, you know, I'm being like all domesticated. I learned how to use iMovie, you guys. Like that was a big accomplishment for me.
What instrument do you play?
I'm sorry. Oh, instrument. I play piano and I play the guitar also. So, and I sing. So I've been doing a lot more of that. I've been playing more video games. I mean, like, I don't know. My life is just more fun now, I think, now that I don't have to commute so much.
Were you raised in a home where you had to practice that piano and you were forced into that?
I kind of was.
A stereotype, you know, but.
It really is a stereotype of Asian kids, but I got to tell you, it's a true stereotype. Like I felt like every Asian kid I knew also was playing the piano. And I was kind of forced to play, but I was a very, very bad student. I would always pretend to play. So like my parents will go out and run errands and I'll pretend I'm playing. Then they leave and I stop playing. And then when I hear the garage door open, I like get back on the piano and pretend I've been playing that whole time. So I didn't have the kind of discipline that maybe some of my friends did, but music is so healing. You know, I think it's just fun to play an instrument and to feel like you're creating something. And so that's been something that's really helpful for me and for my own burnout recovery.
Kate, like being a comedian and going from a stage to stage to stage, do you ever feel burned out in one night? Because I imagine in one night you have so many shows, you're rushing from here to there. Do you ever feel burned out from comedy?
I don't. I feel like I don't get burned out like if I'm actually busy and performing. Like then I'm full of adrenaline and like up forever and like that's when I'm happiest. I feel like with that, my burnout feels like I can't, like, I'm not funny anymore. Like, I can't write any jokes. It's like writer's block, I feel like, would be like my version of burnout.
What about you, Dan?
Well, if I'm doing small sets, like 10, 15 minute sets, like we do here in the city, like at the Cellar, usually after three, I've had enough. And if I'm doing full length sets, like 45 minutes to an hour, one is enough. At two becomes excessive and three becomes impossible. Although I've done that, I've done three. But I don't think I would do it now. I've done it in the past. It's just absolutely, by the third show, you forget if you said the joke during that show or the first show or the second. You don't remember which joke you did at which show. And the audience is not getting the same show. The audience is paying the same money for a different show. They're paying the same money to hear an exhausted comedian that's mind has gone to mush. You know,
it's a lot of energy, I bet, to be a comedian, to be up on that stage. And again, it's like you're taking that feedback in real time and you're making alterations to make your set.
What you can't do is you can't phone it in. It's like you would think that, all right, if you're tired, just get up there and just say the words. But you can't. You have to be so present.
Yes.
Every second. It's hard to just like say, fuck it, I'll just open my mouth and say the words and not think about it. But it really, you can't do that.
Yeah, I really have such respect for comedy. I'm a huge comedy fan. I love stand-up comedy. I think that people who do it have such courage. I mean, like, I have taken classes with people who are non-comedians. Like, we've taken classes like improv for non-comedians, like just to experience that sort of, like you said, that like present-mindedness. And it's like so exhausting, even just in a practice setting when you're in a class, you know, when you're doing improv and you have to respond in the moment. I just can't imagine like doing a whole set like that. And then some days they're amazing. And then some days you have like some a-hole in the audience who's like saying stupid things or interrupting your flow. Like, I don't know how, I mean, that's just a lot to contend with every day, I think.
Do you have certain clients that you can just like phone it in? Like,
oh, I would.
You know them so well that you can just be like, mm-hmm.
I feel like that's what happens when people get burnt out, though, is that they start to phone things in. And so if I find myself getting close to that place, like, I'm just like, okay, you know, you need to rearrange your schedule and you should do something. But no, you know what? That actually is an interesting question because no one's ever asked me that, but I'm extremely present-minded when I'm working with my patients. So like, I could have problems in my own life and I'm like all stressed out, but then like the minute I'm with a patient, it's like, I forget about all of my own stuff. And so it's actually really helpful because in some ways it really gives you perspective on your own problems. It's like, okay, like when you're at work, like you're super present minded and you're just focused on them. I mean, for example, I've had a couple of medical scares. And in my mind, I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm going to get the result today. Like, what's it going to say? But like the minute I'm in front of a patient, I totally forget about it. So
I'm glad you call them patients because a lot of people in your business call them clients.
Yeah.
I like that. They're patients. They're mental patients. And they should be treated as such.
Patients. I think part of the problem.
They're doctors, so they're patients.
Yeah. And I think sometimes people call them clients because maybe they feel like, oh, that like empowers them more. But I also think that sometimes when you use that terminology, then it sounds like almost like customer service sometimes. And I'm not sure how I feel about that. You know, I don't think it's about customer service. I mean, I certainly have patients who are very demanding and they'll say, well, my husband's coming to see you and you need to work with him on his narcissism. And it's like, okay, but you know what? It's your husband's therapy. So like, we'll talk about what to work on. But sometimes we'll have like, you know, family members and loved ones like trying to dictate how the treatment goes. And, you know, I don't think it's.
Did you see Ozark?
No, but I have heard amazing things about it.
Okay, I'm not going to ask you the question then.
Ruin it for me?
Yeah. So I have another question for comedy, for comedians, you know, like, isn't it harder that they have to go on a stage every night, pretend that they're happy, say jokes, make everybody happy. And a lot of them, I know, you know, a lot of them like have like a lot of, maybe not these two, but a lot of like stress and anger and.
Maybe not, but probably.
You know what I'm saying? Like, isn't that putting a layer in front of who you are because of your job could destroy you more?
Who are you asking this?
Anybody.
Well, you mean
we know Geraldo, for example, you know, great Geraldo, you know, like as funny as he, I mean, I know him very well and he's like, he was very depressed, you know, but nobody can see it or tell because he's always on the stage happy. And
I feel like some people are like cats though, you know, like you can never really tell if like a cat's in pain or whatever until like they're dead. And like, there's some, you know, and then other people, but then you have like the flip side where people are like, love to complain and like love to woe is me and like want compassion.
Yeah. But I mean, but for you, even if you, like, if we sit in before the show and you complain and say, I'm miserable, I'm this, and then you go on the stage and you're doing jokes, I'll be like, oh, she's fine.
It's different though. Like, it's different than like being like a Broadway actor where you have like a character that you have to play. And like, this is the character that the script is written. And like, you can't go off of that. So if you're having a bad day, you still have to like do it. But like all the creative stuff, like you take whatever you're feeling in the moment and then put it into like the moment. Mm-hmm. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I think that's part of like the job.
I think the same could be said with a therapist. You know, if you're in a bad, shitty mood, you can't go, and your patients, like, they're not really feeling depressed. You can't be like, yeah, you're not the only one. I mean, you got to put on some sort of, you don't have to be happy, 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 but you can't go in there like, fuck, I don't need to hear about your problems today. You got to project calmness and a certain, your patient. So you're in the same position. Or school teacher. You know, school teacher can't unload on their students.
I had a school teacher though that unloaded all the time though.
Yeah, true.
Well, they might do that, but ideally they wouldn't. And a comedian, at least we have the option of, I guess, integrating our mood a little bit into, I mean, my jokes are what they are, you know. So even though I'm not, as Kate said, I'm not playing a character like on a Broadway show, my jokes do go in a certain direction. Mm-hmm. And some of my jokes might be upbeat and some of them less so, but I can, you know, I can manipulate it a little bit.
Well, I would imagine that in that creative process for you guys as comedians, that it's almost like, even almost like a catharsis or a processing, if you choose to go that way with the comedy, like, hey, like I had this painful experience, but like, I'm going to talk about it and like make it funny. Like I'm going to laugh at it.
You can, but you have to have but I have jokes at work that don't necessarily go in the direction that you're describing. Mm-hmm. So if I have a joke about, like, I could come up with jokes that describe painful experiences, but I don't necessarily have them at hand on a given evening when I might be in a bad mood. So I just have to do my joke about my cousin Sheila coming over my house for sex.
Right.
You know, which is, you know, kind of a lighthearted incest joke. But what's that?
That's, I've seen your sets like a million times, and that's the joke that you decided to go with.
One that came to my mind. The cousin Sheila joke.
Judy, do you see a therapist yourself?
I don't right now, but I have in the past. Yeah. And I think it's really important that you do. Because if you haven't seen a therapist, how are you going to profess to know what it's like to be on the other side and to know your client's experiences? Plus, if you have any kind of thing that you've trying to work through, you need to make sure that you're not bringing that into the room. And so that's one thing that we talk about a lot, you know, when we work with patients, that there's transference. You know, there's certain patients that just like bring certain things out in you. Like maybe a patient reminds you of like somebody you don't like, or, you know, a past relationship or something. And like, you want to make sure that you're bringing your best into the room. So I absolutely think that it's so important that therapists do their own work. Like if you're not going to do your own work, then like, how can you help other people? So no, I think that's important.
Tim brought up earlier, a therapist had said that he would not work with a client or a patient because she was so attractive to him. Mm-hmm. Are there any patients you wouldn't work with for whatever reason? Not necessarily that reason, but some other reason.
Yeah, I think when you think that you really can't be the person to help this person for whatever reason, it's your responsibility to say, you know what, I don't think this is going to be a good partnership, and I'm going to refer you to someone else. And I've definitely done that. And I think it's important to keep an eye on like who those patients are for you. I mean, for me, if I feel like I'm not no longer able to help them, or if I feel like they have extremely poor boundaries and like they won't respect what I think my boundaries are, then you have to refer them elsewhere. Like I've had patients in the past who, you know, again, like they'll just like call me like dozens of times on the weekends, but it's not an emergency, you know? And I'm just like, okay, like we can talk about this in the next session, or if it's an emergency, obviously call me. So like those types of things can happen. And if you just feel like that's not going to work for you and it's not actually therapeutic for anyone, then you can refer them elsewhere. So no, that definitely happens.
Okay. I want to talk about your book, Stop Self-Sabotage, because I think a lot of people need to listen to this right now, you know, because you think during the pandemic, like people are sabotaging themselves without even knowing.
Yep. Totally. I mean, I think that it happens because all of us, you know, are kind of anxiously awaiting what's going to happen next. Like nobody really knows exactly how things are going to go. And I think the self-sabotage happens because in that waiting, you're not moving forward with whatever goals that you say you want to do. And then you're blaming it on maybe the pandemic or something else that's external to you. But, you know, we all self-sabotage sometimes. It's okay. There's no shame about it. We all do it. We're human beings. Like, things happen, but it's more just about refocusing yourself and really thinking about making this time a time of development still. And so it's important to like focus in on your values. Like what are the things that are super important to you right now? Not goals, not bucket lists, but more like, what are the things that you want your life to stand for? You know, integrity, adventure, knowledge, like what is it? Things that truly you value as a human being, and making sure that every day you do something to nurture those values for yourself. I think that's so important because I find that a lot of people are kind of getting lost in all of this and they're just kind of like giving up and they're starting to feel very hopeless. And the more you feel that way, the more you start to feel out of control of your life. And all human beings need to feel like they have some control over their lives.
But self-sabotaging is not only drinking and smoking and drugs, right? Like some people sleep, some people don't just give a shit, you know, some people, you know, right?
Yeah.
People don't know that they're self-sabotaging. How do you know that you have a problem?
Sometimes they don't. And I think, it includes even things like sabotaging your relationships or your career. So you'll know if you're self-sabotaging if you somehow still don't make a lot of progress despite your best intentions, despite saying this is something that I want. It's like, how come you're not making progress? Like, why is that? You know, and that's, I think, when you have to kind of just look into your own mind and be like, okay, what's been holding me back? You know, why do I say I want this and then I'm not getting it, right? Because I think we do have so much power over our own lives. And if you just invite that process in, it's kind of like looking like when you're a kid and you're afraid of like monsters under the bed. It's like, whenever you do actually look in your mind, like it's never as scary as you think it is. But I think a lot of people shy away from like really assessing themselves because they're afraid of what they'll find. And those are also the kind of people who like have a really hard time being alone. They want to be distracted by lots of things all the time. But if you look, it's never as scary as you think it is. And so I think it really starts with that. It really starts with just that recognition that, hey, I do this sometimes. And then what can we do about it? How can we fix the situation?
I should mention that I'm writing a book myself. That's about self-sabotage. It's not like your book. It's not a book about how to overcome self-sabotage. It's a novel about someone that engages in self-sabotage.
Ooh, really? That's cool.
That's the book.
Maybe you should take Dr. Zhou's opinion on that, because that will be a big thing too.
Well, I should probably read her book so that I have more insight on self-sabotage. The book, but I already finished the first draft and I don't want to read anything that will make me realize that everything I said is bullshit. Probably just not read her book.
So tell us about your book. Like, I know it's translated to 7 different languages and it was bestseller, but what's the steps to stop self-sabotage?
So stop self-sabotage is all about 6 scientific steps on how to end self-sabotage in your life forever. And as I mentioned, the first step is really a self-assessment, like find out why you self-sabotage. And secondly, really starting to fix the problem by reorienting your mindset, changing your behaviors, understanding your behavior patterns. And, you know, finally, really attuning to your values, you know, really paying attention to the things that you want to stand for in this life. And then making sure that whatever goals you set for yourself come from those things, you know, so don't just set a goal for yourself because your friend did, or it's a bucket list, like do it because it really comes from an internal drive. That's something that's really important to you. Otherwise, when things get tough, you're just going to check out. You're going to be like, oh, this is too hard. I'm going to give up, right? So, but if it's something that you really care about, like, you know, then those goals stick, you know, then even when the going gets tough, it sticks. And I think a big part of what I talk about in the book is how we become very afraid of our own negative feelings. And it's okay to have negative emotions. I mean, the emotions are there for a reason. It's not going to hurt you. But I think sometimes people, the minute they feel a negative emotion, like, oh my gosh, I have to make this go away. Like whatever it takes to make it go away. So if it means not showing up at this party because I'm socially anxious, like I just won't go anymore, even though I know it's going to be good for me. Let me just have a drink because that will make me feel better. You know, people just push away their negative feelings instead of just saying, hey, I can withstand this. It's just a feeling. It's going to pass in like a couple hours or maybe even a couple minutes.
Okay.
You know, I'm looking at your website here, the Judy Ho self-sabotage quiz.
Yes.
The photo, you look like Beyonce. Are you seeing that? Do you see that photo, Hot Tem?
I'll go for it right now.
Self-sabotage, find out, and then it says, take the interactive life assessment, and then she looks like Beyonce in that photo. I don't know how she pulled that off.
Can you share it with us? You can share if you want.
How to do that.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, it was a photo shoot. I had professional makeup and a professional photographer. So that's better than any kind of filter that you can get on Instagram. But yeah, so I did a photo shoot for my book. It was fun. And yeah, there's a quiz on my website if you guys want to take it to find out how you self-sabotage. People love that quiz because people like to find out about themselves. Like, wait, like, what am I doing that's tripping me up? And what's stopping me from getting to my goals, you know?
What's the test about?
So the test is about what your life factor is. And so you'll find out for most people, it's one or more of four factors that cause them to self-sabotage. I love that Dan just made it his.
There you go.
Yeah. That's like a Mariah Carey or Beyonce a little bit, but kind of a combination.
Asian Beyonce. So anyway, the life factors are lower shaky self-esteem, internalized beliefs, fear of the unknown or fear of change, and then E stands for excessive need for control. So by taking this like 3-minute quiz, you'll find out which of those types you are and why that type holds you back.
Okay. And can you tell us a little bit about your podcast that you host, Supercharged Podcast?
Yeah. So I have a new podcast. It's called Supercharged Life with Dr. Judy. And it's all about helping people to learn practical tools to improve their life and wellness, health, mental health, career, relationships. And I interview a lot of really cool guests and they share some of their tips and I talk about my tips, and every episode has several tips that you can use today to improve your life. And I've had so many amazing guests on the show so far, but one of my favorites has to be Paula Abdul. She was on one of the early episodes and, like, you know, I grew up really loving her music and it was so fun talking to her. Like, she told me so many surprising stories about her life. I just can't believe this woman. She would like get kicked and she would just like get back up again. She'd get kicked again. She'd get back up. Like, she's very, very strong and severe through a lot of stuff. So
she is great.
You look like her too a little bit.
So, a lot of, you know, you were saying that, you know, you don't drive to work, which is much better. You know, a lot of us are creating habits right now mm-hmm. that we're going to need to break later on. And I'm sure that's going to cause stress. So, yep. And I know that you talked about how to break habits and how to build a new healthy ones. So how would you do that? If I'm used to now, like, just chilling at home the whole time, go running and exercise like 5 hours a day, you know, how's that going to change when
Well, one is, if you want to start a new habit, don't wait for tomorrow. Sometimes people will say things like, well, okay, I'm just going to have a crazy weekend and then I'll start on Monday. But don't do that. Just start today. And when you start, you can start small. So even if your goal in the end is to, like, I don't know, run 4 times a week, you don't have to think about that right now. You just have to do something small today, even if you just ran 5 minutes today. And so I think that sometimes people get held up with their habits because they're like, oh my gosh, like, I see the road and the journey ahead and it's too hard. But if you just do one small thing every day, that's how habits happen. And you have to give yourself some patience because on average, it takes 3 to 4 weeks to establish a new habit. So, you know, if you like mess up a couple times, like, just expect that. I think everybody should expect that they're going to mess up.
But what if it's the opposite? If you actually built a good habit now because you have a lot of time on your hand, you know, and now you have to break that good habit because you got to have to go back to work and all that.
Well, then I think it's really about picking the habits that are truly important to you, then you want to be able to fit into your life when it gets super busy again. And so maybe pick your top three, and then just recognizing that you might not be able to do it to the extent that you're doing it now. Like, I'm sure when the country opens up more, I'm not going to get to play piano as much as I'm playing it right now, but I still want to make a commitment to that. So it might just be, okay, instead of getting to play every other day, it might just be once a week, but set aside time for that. I think it's really important that you actually carve out the time. I put them like in my calendar if I really want to make sure to stick to it. So just make sure that you still make time and realize that a lot of the benefits don't come from you doing something for 2-3 hours. Like, you can get benefits from doing something for 10 to 15 minutes.
Interesting. All right, last question. Are you optimistic about the near future?
That's such a tough question right now. You know, in general, I'm an optimist. I think I'm a cautious optimist right now because there is a lot of stuff going on. But I think it's really all about, you know, us being together as a community and remembering like that our actions affect other people. I mean, more than ever in the pandemic, that's true. Like, to beat the pandemic, we all have to be responsible, right? We all have to like social distance and wear masks and like do all those things so that we can get over it together. And so, I mean, I think that it's going to be a really interesting time because right now I feel closer to my fellow Americans and even people of the world than I ever have because we're all going through this together. So that's the thing that I really want, you know, people to think about is like, okay, this could end up being like a really beautiful like unveiling of our new world if we can all work together and remember the community.
I'm looking, by the way, at your Wikipedia page. It says you speak fluent Mandarin.
Yes, I do. I was born in Taiwan, so that is the national language of Taiwan. And yeah,
speak like a native level fluency?
Yes, I was born there, so I read and I write and I speak fluently.
I tried to study it, you know, just because I had some free time, and it just I gave up after about a week because it's just impossible.
Yeah. 3 to 4 weeks in order to make it a habit, Dan.
Yes. But, give it more time, Dan.
I'm just going to stick with my French, which I've been studying for 13 years, and just work on that.
Wow. That's amazing.
Because that's actually doable. Mandarin is impossible. First of all, you got those tones.
I know. They're so hard. I mean, you could be saying something completely offensive just with like the wrong tone, even though it sounds like the right word.
You know that Hatem and Mandarin, the same word has different meanings depending on the tone. So like, ma means one thing and ma means something else and ma means something else.
Yep. Yeah. All those things that you just said right now means mom, scolding, and I think the last one is like feeling like a physical tingling. So like all of those three things that he just said,
wow,
like they are. Yep.
That's crazy. And Dan, you perform in French too, right?
I have done. Yes, I have.
That's
yes.
Pretty impressive.
But it's very exhausting. And after about 15 minutes, it's like I run a marathon because I can't just, I've got to be so worried about saying the wrong thing. You know, I have to really think about it because it's not automatic. It has to pass through my English filter before it into the French, you know, especially with a joke, which is, I mean, I can have a conversation, you know, because when you have a conversation, if you fuck up, you just say it again. But on stage, you can't fuck it up.
Right.
The joke is ruined. So you have to be right the first time. So that requires like, do you ever do therapy, by the way, in Mandarin? Do you offer that service to your Mandarin clients?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do. Yeah. And it definitely is because it's still like using that language in a more professional way. I don't feel like as proficient in it as I would just talking to somebody in Mandarin if I were like out at dinner, you know, because you like use medical terms and I'm a little less familiar with those. But yeah, I mean, it's all, I mean, what you were just saying, Dan, it's like, it's a lot of like in the moment stuff too with language, right? So like when you feel stilted in a conversation, it's so frustrating. So I get it. You spent 13 years like investing in French. So you're going to keep doing that.
Yeah, I figured I'll keep doing that, and because I'll never ever have native fluency. So I have my whole life. I can still try to get better. I won't reach the goal. So rather than diverting time with Mandarin or something else, I'll just concentrate on what I can do. Because like Mandarin, and also you can't read it. Like you have one of those characters which are just unbelievably different.
Yeah. There's like no relationship to English whatsoever. That's the tough thing about something.
None of the vocabulary. There are almost zero free words. Like in French, a lot of free words. Intelligent, restaurant, intéressant. Mm-hmm. You know, there's thousands of them. In Mandarin, every word is, you got to learn from scratch.
And also in French, you can pretend that you know the word, like restaurant, like you said. We don't know if that's true. We don't speak French. You can just be saying whatever right now. But like
you know, almost every big word in English is the same in French. Like, take any...
Well, it's all Latin derivative, right? It's all
Latin. Yeah.
Latin, yeah. It's a Romance language. And almost any word of three or more syllables is the same. International, you know, you get the...
You know what's the same in every language? Super.
I don't know about Mandarin, but maybe.
Yeah, definitely not Mandarin, but like, yeah, like Italian, like... Spanish.
Anywhere in the world that you can go, like even in China, you can go or Taiwan and say super and people will know what you mean.
They actually do. do. They actually do. And actually in Taiwan and China, like a lot of people speak English now. So it makes it easy.
There you go. Well, thank you so much, Judy, for being here. Finally, great to see you. And you got to come and visit in New York. Let us know when you come in. And we'll take you to some comedy show. Watch these guys.
I can't wait.
Yeah. Dan, do you want to share your information?
Libra.
He likes long walks in the park.
Long walks in the park. And I'll try anything once. And if I like it, who knows? At Dan Natterman is my handle on all social media. At Dan Natterman. That is all. Okay.
Scott DeKent, you want to share your information?
Yeah. You guessed it. It's at Scotch the Cat on all social media.
Nice. And Dr. Ho, you want to share your information?
Yes, at Dr. Judy Ho on all social media, DrJudyHo. Thanks again for having me, guys.
Well, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Hi, everybody. And
it's live from America Podcast. Dan, hold on. Thank you, guys. Just...